He raises a question, responding to a previous lesson, a question about marriage and celibacy. You said that what the young man or young woman will follow is a matter of the person's inner inclination. The kli with an iota and of God's calling. The kli with an eta, that is, a calling. I will tell you further on, how can we come to understand the calling of God? The calling with an eta. About the path we will follow, not only on the matter of marriage, but for all the serious questions of our life. Inclination, with an iota, means what I have, what is called an aptitude. That is, I say, I have an inclination to become an engineer. I have a particular inclination to hold a screwdriver or to make drawings. Or, I am an artist, an inclination to paint. So inclination, with an iota, means a yearning of the soul for something. Calling, with an eta, means a call from the good. And this call is made by God. God, of course, I must tell you, calls on the basis of the inclination a person already has. The kli with an iota. There are three great things that a young person especially must come to know. There are the inclinations with an iota. There are the callings with an eta. And there are the abilities. Sometimes I may have an inclination with an iota, a yearning toward something, but not have the ability, or the abilities, to respond to that inclination. And of course the abilities, depending on the thing, on the object, may be spiritual, that is, intellectual. They may be emotional or volitional. They may even be bodily. These abilities that must respond to that inclination I have. I have an inclination, for example, to become a footballer. But I suffer from rheumatism, so of course I cannot become a footballer. Or I have an enlarged heart, or in any case my heart does not respond. My biological heart does not respond to running on that field. So we have the inclination. I desire it. I see it in my sleep, as we were saying before, I desire it. But I cannot respond, because I do not have the abilities. So then, if God has placed within me some inclination, because there are many inclinations, you know, they are the so-called interests. If, for example, you go with your school to a factory, and that factory is very interesting, and your Greek teacher sets you an essay, you will all write that you want to become engineers at that factory, because an interest was awakened. But that is a false interest, or better. More precisely, it is an interest, but they are false callings. A person has one inclination. These many inclinations that exist correspond to certain passing interests, and therefore we cannot say that they make up a person's principal inclination. For a person to discover his principal inclination is not always easy, it is true. And to discover further his abilities in relation to that inclination, this too is not always easy. And this is true. I would tell you that only when someone is humble will he be able to manage to see inclination and abilities clearly. I, for example, let us say that I love Byzantine music. If I cannot chant, if I do not have the ability to chant, I cannot. I love it, but I cannot. If now I have the humility and say that I cannot. Despite our efforts, sometimes, you know, we can dig a talent out from within us, out of the soil of our existence. Yes, I do not deny it, but it is something that also shows itself, if you like. It shows, just as ancient things are sometimes buried. And something may stick out above, out of the ground. And one can say, look, here is an object worth excavating. But if I have humility, I will say, I do not have the talent to chant. If I do not have humility, then I will keep trying to live up to my desire, to my inclination. Not to mention that sometimes I may even reach the point of making us all look ridiculous. So you see people climbing up onto the chanter's stand. People about whom one says, oh dear, those who go and surround the chanter stand at a liturgy, at a vigil, they crowd around it and they too want to chant. If only it were truly a yearning of the soul. Many times it is vainglory. It is showing off. And one says, oh dear, our ears suffer when we hear these screechings, these strange things. My brother, a little humility. I am no good for chanting, none at all. So, if we have humility, sometimes we find our real ability that corresponds to our real inclination. Now what would you say about the calling that God will give us, the calling with an eta? Will it be something that lies outside my abilities and the inclination God placed in me? Who gave me the abilities? What am I? Whatever I am from God. And the inclination, the yearning, Where did it come from? From God. How is it possible now for God to call me to something apart from inclination and ability? Is it possible? So I must say that the calling I will receive from God will be in accord with what exists within me, as endowments, as abilities, as desire. What I am showing you, I told you, take note of it, because there exist offices for professional orientation counseling. There are teachers who specialize in these matters. There are tests. I do not know what all there is. There is a great deal. But the basic and fundamental things are the ones I told you. Inclinations with an iota, abilities and callings with an edia. Of course, those who counsel on the basis of certain capacities do not include the calling with an edia. Let us not forget that every person has a purpose in life, and God destines every person to a purpose, and not only for salvation. Of course, everything must end in salvation, but at the same time, for the church to be served, for society to be served, how will God bring all this about? When He places these abilities, these, we might say, these talents, these charisms, within a person, then these charisms, these talents, these abilities build up the church, and God is glorified. Of course we say the church because it is the church that is in question, whereas someone outside the church would say society. Take it however you wish. The correct thing is to say, for the church. So how can I know what I am for? In this specific question, am I for marriage? Am I for celibacy? Here is a specific question because many times with professions too, we get confused there as well. But I am not speaking about profession. I am speaking about this specific question. Because he says, even in other serious matters of our life, but I take up this one. My children, honestly, it is not easy to discover what God wants you for, this or that. But take note, what we will try to do is to keep God's commandments. When we keep God's commandments, there comes a moment when we understand what God wants us for, what we are capable of, provided we keep God's commandments. If a child can ask the question that was asked last time, how can I match with a boy, that is, with the prospect of an immoral friendship or with the prospect of marriage? If it is with the prospect of marriage, there is no issue at this moment, because you are a young girl and you cannot occupy yourself with this matter. So with some things, there comes a fullness of time, and within that fullness of time we understand. We cannot ask prematurely. We can ask, but we will wait. Until that fullness of time comes for us to see where we are meant to be, what we ought to do, what the Lord said to that. Rich young man, keep the commandments. We will live the Christian life, and at some point God will show us. For what, I ask you, is the second decade of a person's life? What is adolescence? Adolescence, in these matters of celibacy and marriage, is unsteady. It is full of temptations. In the midst of these temptations, these relentless temptations, can you draw any conclusion about whether you are suited for this or for that? Your conclusion will be false. It will be mistaken when you say, oh, I am going through these temptations. I am not suited for celibacy. And then when you reach the third decade of your life, you see that you got it wrong. And you may at times come to regret rushing into marriage when you see that you were in fact meant for celibacy. So then we have to come out of a region, a critical region at least. Some things within us must quiet down, must settle. And there we will begin to see ourselves clearly. Until then, what should I do? I will say it for the third time. I will keep the commandments of God. Indeed, on this very point, it seems to me I told you once before. But I will say it again, what the Apostle Paul says. I would wish you all, he says to the Corinthians, to be as I am. How did the Apostle Paul describe himself? Unmarried, he would wish it. Yes, but he himself, who stands within reality, says each one has his own gift. Marriage is not a lesser gift. Marriage is not a small gift. Nor is it a small gift to bear children and to raise children. It is a gift to bring children into the world and to make them into upright people. I will say it once more. It is a gift. Just consider that the mother must occupy herself with nothing else. Not with offices, nor with commerce, nor with the police force, nor with the army, but with the upbringing of her children. Why? Because it is a very great undertaking, and it leaves room for nothing else, only for this. So you understand that to raise children in the right way, you must have the talent, the gift for it. That is why the Apostle Paul says, each one has his own gift. Put me to mind, children, and I will tell you I grow weary. I would toss it out the window, because it is crying. Of course, I would not really toss it. It is a manner of speaking. I do not have it. I cannot. To raise children, to teach you a lesson, I can. But to raise children the way a mother and a father raise a child, I cannot. I do not have that gift. I have something else. You see, then, when will I see this? When I pass, as I told you, through a season, an age when I cannot judge clearly. There is a storm. I cannot judge. But until then, I will take as given what the Apostle Paul said. That is, I will set before myself that I will remain unmarried, and if it turns out, children, that I am to marry, that is, that I have the gift for marriage, nothing will hold me back. I will simply marry. What is the gain? That until then, I will have guarded myself from sin, from immorality. Why? Because if early on I plant in myself the thought that I ought to marry, I will sit and watch who this one is and who that one is and how this one is and how that one is. But these things will harm me. So I say I will not marry. When the hour comes and I see this desire within me to marry, then I will have escaped the temptations of immorality. And if, on the other hand, God destines me to remain unmarried, then I also have a foundation. A foundation that is not useless for marriage either, for he says that I had delighted in that wonderful book of his, which one is thought to be old. It is not old, pure youth, he says. My child, you stay pure, and purity will be easier for your children, because a foundation will have been laid, we might say, in favor of self-mastery. And this is the great gain and the great capital. This is what I had to say about this question. And I come now to a second one. As we know, many of the school textbooks contain facts and theories contrary to Christianity. What should our stance toward these be? Very rightly asked. Pay attention, children. To this, of course, it is not a phenomenon of our age alone. It is a phenomenon of other ages, too. In the time when I went to school, I remember that, back then, they would turn against Byzantium. And it was said that Byzantium was the dark Middle Ages. It seems Byzantium had to be discovered by the Europeans, because we do nothing but ape them. Whatever the foreigners have, we accept it too, and we cannot upon our own heritage form our own judgment and develop it. This is a defect of ours, because we are conformists, that is, we imitate, as though we do not want to act on our own in anything. It is a strange thing, this mania for all things. Foreign devours us and lays us waste. So there was the notion, among certain authors who had written some books about Byzantium, that Byzantium is of no worth, neither from a philosophical standpoint nor in art, and so on, that it is nothing, of no significance. And there was a turn toward classical antiquity, which, as was said then, and is still said today, had been harmed by the dark Middle Ages of Byzantium. Of course, the Europeans came around again. These are the things I remember being said in the time when I was at school, in the history lesson. It seems Europe had to come again and discover, first of all, the icon. You have seen what a great affair is being made over the icon, because we have these sacrilegious people who steal the icons and sell them for astronomical sums and smuggle them outside the borders of Greece in the most criminal ways, because they have value. At first, they had no value. Of course, the real question is how an object comes to be valued. Now, because they said that Byzantine art has value, now, of course, an old icon, now it has value. So the whole matter of the art of Byzantium began to be reconsidered, yes. Today, these icons of ours, these icons made for veneration, adorn the drawing rooms and the museums of the Europeans. So then, what did they discover? Indeed, modern art helped with this too, art that is no longer in space, but on a flat plane, and because our age is also anti-realistic in the field of art. For this reason, because they encounter these very features in the Byzantine icon, which is not set in space, is not three-dimensional, and is not realistic, but is anti-listic, but is anti-realistic and anti-naturalistic. For this very reason, a Byzantine icon today has very, very great value. Byzantine art has come to be regarded as a forerunner of modern art. Are the proof of this not the icons that are sold at such enormous prices? What is going on here? Of course, either the foreigners do not make sound evaluations, or because they hate Greece and would not want Greece to be exalted. This is well known. They put forward various theories. And we rush to take up these theories, We do not hesitate to put them even into our school textbooks. And then the harm is dreadful, because now the young Greeks learn things that are not correct. Things that concern Greek history, and things that concern this science as well, such as Darwinism. What could we say about all this? Well, children, leave aside what the grown-ups will do. And the children themselves. I remember, it happened in our own day too. I will not say much more on this point, on how it was done, and how we received help to do this thing. What is needed is to be able to make a critique. 1, 2, 3, pupils, boys and girls, will stand up, and they will speak with courtesy. Pay attention. With courtesy. Forgive me, professor. Of course, the school textbook says these things, but I think they are not correct. And especially if he is a good student, well read, or has been helped by his parents or by some other persons, he is in a position to make this critique, and to say that the matter is not so, but is thus and thus. So there must be a critique and a counterargument, not only a statement, but also a counterstatement. And I always stress, courteously. We will not speak insolently to our teachers. Rather, we will speak as good interlocutors. Like a pupil who wants to learn and investigates his subject. So, do not hesitate to do this wherever the need arises. But if you say to me, as often happens with university students, and indeed students of theology, that something may come up which the student does not accept, of course, I will write it as the professor's book, or the school textbook says it. I will write it as it says, because otherwise they will give me a zero. And then what happens? I must be an excellent student, write flawlessly, hold my objections, and then the professor cannot give me a zero. It is my right to hold this view. But if I am not a good student, if I am a mediocre student, then I have no choice but to write what the book says. Yet within myself I will reject what is being taught. We might say, suppose the first Christians had to go to school. The children of the first Christians had to go to school. What were they to do? To learn their letters. Do not go far afield. Take John Chrysostom, who studied under a renowned teacher of rhetoric, Libanius, a philosopher and orator, who had his own school, of course. What did John Chrysostom do there? He took those things he needed, the things he ought not to take, since Libanius was an idolater. He rejected. Of course, as lessons he may not have rejected them, he rejected them in his life. What did Basil the Great and St. Gregory the Theologian do when they came to wise Athens? Which was, however, idolatrous. They learned their letters. They learned their letters. So, even though idolatry is not taught in the lessons themselves, what did they do? Did they start to curse their teachers? Far from it. They could make a critique. Most probably, yes. But they learned those things there, and they served them as foundations, so that later, when they would be the preachers from the pulpit and the writers, they could strike at all these things, could strike them down. So then, children, as you see, we can make a critique. We can have our counter-argument. We will also learn the things that are said. We will sit our examinations according to the lessons as they are. But we will never accept these positions. And indeed, if these positions should multiply, in all the schools of Greece, and the teachers should protest to their administration that our pupils do not accept these things, would that it happen somewhat like this. But unfortunately, it does not happen. Then, of course, many of those who compile these school textbooks would consider whether they ought to put in these positions or those. So much for this question. And here is another. Pay attention to it. It says, there is often talk of the effects of a certain political party on our spiritual course. It is commonly accepted that this or that party acts as a hindrance to our Christian faith. How can the various parties affect our Christian standing positively or negatively? And by what criteria should our party alignment be made? Children, I could say much to you, but I will say only a couple of words. And hear me, I consider it a true calamity at this moment. In Greece, a true calamity, I consider it, that the student world, that is, the school, going in university, going youth, has become politicized. It is a true calamity. Our youth ought to be in the arena of education and knowledge, and not going out onto the pavement to lose their lessons, to shout slogans, and so on. The trouble is that it has gone too far, and I do not know. Perhaps it will become worse further on. I do not know, when we abandon our lessons and go out onto the pavement and shout in favor of this or that party. It is, I tell you, a misfortune. It is a misfortune. This will bring forth many evil things. And first of all, it will bring forth a generation of the unlettered. Our youth will remain unlettered. There is no time left for education. I condemn. It is my right to do so. All those things as well that go on inside the school, that we elect a president, a council, that we confront the teachers, that we exclude them from the classroom while we hold our council, and that we go to protest and to impose our will. And especially in the following manner, that if some fellow pupil of ours is expelled, we stage a walkout, a strike, an abstention, we do not come in formation, because, and so on, and his punishment will be pardoned, and many other such things. These things are not good things. I speak sincerely and objectively. I am not speaking in favor of anyone. I speak objectively, as far as I can understand, that I am speaking objectively. These are not good things. They do not serve the education of our young people, our new generation. So to all of this, I would answer that the young must not become politicized. It is one thing to vote. You here do not vote. The university student votes. Anyone over 18. The pupil in primary school or high school is not supposed to vote, since we finish high school at 18, so we do not vote. But the university student does vote. It is one thing to vote, which is both a duty and a right. I have both a duty and a right to cast my vote. And it is another thing to vote for the one I judge worthy, the one I have weighed in order to judge him, and not because he will do me a favor in some affair of mine. And it is another thing altogether to be a politicized person. These are two different things. If at this moment, with some young people listening to me here, my voice could of course be heard farther afield, where would it be heard, and who would heed it? So many people can speak at this moment, and yet remain unheard. But to you whom I have before me, I would say, do not become politicized. As for voting, your parents, or you yourselves, once you are grown, will vote. But take care, do not become politicized, so that you do no harm to yourselves. Look to your lessons. Look to your school, and set everything else aside. Politicization is not for you. With these very few words, I have also answered this third question. Now, the first question, what meaning does it have for Christians that history is divided into before Christ and after Christ? It is a fine question, and rather original as a question from young people, of course. What meaning does it have for us Christians? Indeed, it has a very great meaning. What does it mean that the birth of Christ was set as the reckoning point of history? It means that history was cut, historically, into two pieces, what we call before Christ and what we call after Christ. And the astonishing thing is that this measuring of time was accepted not only by Christians, but also by non-Christians. Even though, of course, it is well known that every people had its own way of measuring time. You know this? Do you not? You know that the ancient Greeks measured by Olympiads, the Romans measured from the founding of Rome, the Hebrews measured from the creation of the world, and the Babylonians and all the other peoples measured, each having its own starting point. And if you want yet another example, after Christ we have the Muslims, who measure from the birth of Muhammad. There was therefore a varied, and we might say, rich system of measurement. The ancient Greeks, as I told you, measured every 4 years. By Olympiads, or there were various other starting points for measuring time. One difficulty we have in fixing something historically is precisely that there was this very great variety in the measuring of time. There was no single, unified reckoning of time. What is astonishing is that peoples who did not become Christians use the Christian chronology. So if you go to China or to Japan, they may indeed have their own reckoning. But alongside it, they place the Christian one. The Hebrews, in a periodical they publish, it is called Chronica, a Greek one, place two dates. The first expresses the reckoning from the creation of the world, and the other from the birth of Christ, even though they are not Christians. What does this mean? It means that there were no great world, historical events, no towering, great persons who, by their personality and their greatness, could impose themselves upon history. Only Christ imposed himself. Here is the astonishing thing. For us, children, the value lies in this, that the birth of Christ stands as a landmark in history, which means that for us it is of great importance that we are Christians. Because this is worth, I am a Christian, Christ is a great person, he is a very great person. He imposed himself upon all the events and all the persons of history, And so the world is divided historically into two great pieces, into the history before Christ and the history after Christ. And likewise, what is the center of the earth? As you know, the ancient Greeks regarded Delphi as the navel of the earth, that is, its center. And there in the Museum of Delphi, there is preserved a sculpture, said to be the Omphalos, which marked the point of the navel of the earth. But what is the navel of the earth? What is the center of the earth? Delphi, with its Amphictyonies and the Delphic spirit. Do you know what Delphos? Delphi means? This is why there were the Amphictyonies and the Delphic spirit. Delphos means belly, it means womb. Brother, sister, take note, in Adelphos the alpha is not privative, it is collective. And when we say Adelphos, it means that you and I, who are brothers, came out of the same womb, from the same Delphos. So this is what Delphi means, the belly that gives birth to many persons who are brothers among themselves. As I told you, the alpha is collective. So the center of the earth is Delphi. Others would say that the center of the earth is Rome, or whatever else. Children, the center of the earth is Golgotha, whether we want it or not. In time, history was cut in two before and after Christ. In space, the world was cut in two, or rather, it came to have a center, and that center is the cross of Christ, and the cross of Christ was planted upon Golgotha. So the center of the earth, I would even say the center of the universe, not merely of the earth, is Golgotha, because Christ will come to judge the world, and the whole universe will be made new. It will be changed, says the evangelist John in the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, and the apostle Peter says it too, and the Old Testament says it. I saw, he says, new heavens and a new earth. By virtue of what will this new heaven and new earth come to be? By virtue of the God-man, person of Christ, and of the sacrifice of Christ upon Golgotha. This has worth for us Christians. Immense worth. Today, people boast and say, I am a Rotarian, I am a Freemason, or I belong to this or that football team, or to this or that learned society, and so on. Before the title, I am a Christian. All of these grow pale. My dear children, let us not be ashamed to say that we are Christians. So this division of time, with the birth of Christ as its starting point, has very great worth indeed. Another question says, when Satan presents himself before a person in the form of God, does God always reveal something of the devil, such as, for example, horns, a tail, and so on? Not always. Children, not always. The devil comes to tempt a person and appears, as the Apostle Paul says, as an angel of light. And the strange thing, says the Apostle Paul, speaking on account of certain people who were warring against the faith, yet had the name of being faithful. These false brethren, as the Apostle Paul calls them, he calls them dogs, evil workers, the Apostle Paul calls them. And he says there, what is so strange, if this Satan, the devil, transforms himself into an angel of light, that his instruments too, his followers, should also appear clothed in the fleece of the sheep, of goodness and of virtue? So then, not always. And how will the faithful one be saved here? Take note of something. Suppose you ever happen to see something like this, perhaps in your sleep, it can happen. You would want to be able to discern whether it is from God or from the devil. Take note. If you have humility, much humility, and you are not ready to accept it, then be sure, children, that God will show you a sign in that false vision and false dream, in a false Christ that presents itself, and in a false Theotokos, and in a false saint. He will show a little sign that you will notice, and at once you will say, this is from the devil. When will this happen? When we possess humility. When we possess humility. When we do not possess it, then God lets the vision appear as it is, and the person is deceived. His delusion is his punishment, because he is proud. If you ask me what kind of humility I should have, well, first of all, I should be a humble person in my whole life. But on this particular matter, how can I show that I have humility? How do I understand what I am calling humility? Like this, I will never be eager to bow down and worship anything that appears before me. If I keep in mind that the Lord told me to be careful and on my guard, what did he tell us? Behold, here is Christ. Behold, there he is, they will tell you. Do not believe it. Here is a very beautiful example from two ascetics. Once the devil appears as Christ and says to an ascetic, I am Christ. Now, what should have happened? not in sleep, but wide awake. What should have happened here? Christ told us, the ascetic answers, that people will say, "Behold, here is Christ, behold, there he is." Do not believe it. Christ told us, they will tell you, "Here is Christ here, here is Christ there." Do not believe it. The moment he spoke these words, which were humility, that is, he showed humility. He held fast to what Christ had said. The one thought to be Christ vanished. It was the devil. And a second example, again the devil appears to an ascetic and says to him, "I am Christ." Do you know how many have fallen for it? Do you know how many bowed down and worshipped? Do you know how many lost their minds, went mad? They worshipped the devil. They went out of their senses. And then that ascetic sighed and said, "Who am I to be worthy to see Christ? I ask for nothing but to see him when the resurrection of the dead comes." And the devil vanished. This is what humility means. Did you want to see what pride looks like? Then, listen. The moment I see this supposed Christ, I go out into the neighborhood, and for the rest of my life I go around saying, "I saw Christ, I saw the most holy Theotokos," and I boast. I am full of pride, wanting to show everyone that I am something. People come to me very often, men and women, and when I try to correct something in their life, it happens that they say nothing in confession. Listen carefully to me. They say nothing. Fine, but you commit no sin at all. We have nothing to confess. But is it possible? We are sinners, we are all human beings, and he answers you at once to shut your mouth. "You know, I saw Christ, I rejoice greatly." That is exactly your delusion, that you say you saw Christ, and you go so far as to say that you have no sins. Why? You draw this conclusion, since I saw Christ, it means I have no sins. Here is the great delusion, which is due to the pride of man, and I believe you have understood how the matter stands. And I come to a third question, fasting in adolescence. How should an adolescent deal with his family in the case where his fasting is hindered? Here I would have a great many things to say, but I will limit myself to only a very few. And it will be, we might say, a skeleton of a rich subject. Take note, children. Fasting is a commandment of God, and we are obliged to keep the commandments of God. Precisely because the first created ones did not keep the commandment of fasting. God said, "You shall not eat from the fruit." Fasting, not eating, fasting, that is, you shall not eat. This is what fasting means, fasting. The first created ones transgressed the commandment of God. Which commandment? The commandment of fasting. And they sinned and lost paradise. You see then, that this commandment, which some think is a small one, the commandment of fasting, and that it does not matter much, was therefore far from small. Not to say that they distort it and say that what enters does not harm, but what comes out, and many other things that have nothing to do with fasting, but are the Lord's teaching on another subject. Fasting, then, is a commandment of God, but it is a commandment that has a very rich pedagogical character. When we say pedagogical, it means especially this commandment, which is also the first one that was given in paradise, and which, we might say, is also introductory to the rest of the virtues, introductory. That is why, you know, among the deadly sins, which are seven, the first sin, the one that introduces the rest of the sins, is gluttony, which is the opposite of fasting. If gluttony is the gate of the deadly passions, then evidently fasting is the gate of the virtues. But because it is, we might say, an introductory virtue, it has a very rich pedagogical character, chiefly and above all for childhood, adolescence, and youth. For the pedagogical value of fasting is so rich that I would need a great deal of time to sit and analyze this point for you. But I would tell you, when I can say no, in just a few words, when I can say no, because God says no, this means first, that I have a trained intellect that grasps the will of God. Second, I have a will tempered like steel, so that I can say no. It is no easy thing to be able to say no. When, for example, the sirens of sin call out to me, can I say no? And in this life, how many things there are that call out to me and lead me into sin? I can say no only if I steel my will. And what steels my will? Virtue, the commandment of fasting. Because if I say no to food, I will also say no to immorality. Did you hear that? Did you take note of what I said? If some child asks me how I can remain continent, how I can avoid the sins of the flesh, I would say, learn to fast. With all the consistency, the thing requires, What does that mean? Learn to say no. And when you learn to say no to foods, you will learn to say no to the pleasures as well. And this has very great value and importance. But when I say no, because my will is tempered like steel, the feeling does not remain a stranger to it. Because I love the God who tells me no, so that in this way I can remain a stranger to sin and far from it. So, my intellect grasps the commandment, my feeling agrees with what God says, and I love God for what he tells me. I do it with joy, and my will is tempered like steel. If a person manages to build, I do not know with what words I should often speak to you. I want to speak, and I am hindered. I do not know how to make you understand me, and many times I search to find the words. And I tell you truly, I am hindered to build a beautiful character, intellect, will, and feeling. If a person builds these, does he not become a beautiful personality? There you have the pedagogical value of the commandment of fasting, and so that you will not forget how important this is, I need only remind you of a very characteristic example from Holy Scripture. When the captivity of the southern kingdom, that is, of Judah, came about under Nebuchadnezzar, he dragged the whole people off, of course, to Babylon, and among the captives were four splendid young men. They were not really grown men. They were young boys, like adolescents. These young men, these children, were under 20 years of age. They were the so-called three youths in the renowned Daniel, who in age was a little older than the other three children. They were from the tribe of Judah. They were of royal descent. They were children of nobility. This carries weight, what I am saying, that they were children of nobility, because it is presumed that they had learned in their home to be like children of nobility. But look and see. When they were carried off to Babylon, and the king took from all the peoples he had enslaved, for Babylonia was an empire there at that time, he took the choicest of the young men and brought them to his palace. He used, you might say, the tests of his day, the screening process of his era, and out of all of them, all the Hebrews, all the captives, he chose only these four boys. Only these four boys. Think, what a strict selection that was. And he gave orders that they attend lessons inside the palace, and even that, they eat from the king's own food. Now, since they were noble-born children, one might say, allow me the expression, how fortune had favored them to find themselves once again in a royal setting. But what fortune, and how were they favored? They believed neither in luck nor in favors. They believed in God, and in God alone. And then when they saw the foods of the Babylonians that the law of Moses forbade, things like pork, roasted veal, all browned and crisped, they said, ah, no, no, fasting. So they go and tell the cook, and the cook in that time was also a counselor to the king, a kind of general too. I don't have more time to explain to you the why and the how, but in fact the one who burned Jerusalem was the cook of Nebuchadnezzar, and he was the one who plundered it. And the fathers give it a mystical interpretation like this. Look, they say, Jerusalem is the church. It is the soul. And by whom was it plundered? By the cook, by gluttony, by the foods. So they go and say to the cook, we beg you, we want only legumes and vegetables. Impossible, he says, because if the king notices that you're growing weak, then woe to me. So they tell him, for 10 days give us legumes. And if you see that we've grown weak, then give us from the meats that you have on the king's table. And God enlightened him. Listen, because this is also an answer to what I said earlier. To the question, how are we to deal with our family when they don't believe? God enlightened him, and he says, all right, and they ate legumes. When the days had passed, the royal cook saw that they were rosy and healthy, and in the end he agreed never to give them anything from the king's table. The other children, now students in the school inside the palace, would go and take those crisped, browned little pigs and bring them right up to their noses. But these four never ate. Pay attention. Not even once. Not even once. And when the time of the examinations came, the king himself wanted to test the wisdom of the students. Do you know what he found? That the only ones worthy of wisdom were these four young men, and all the rest he sent away. Because, of course, when you eat well and drink well, do you know what the ancient Greeks used to say? That, a wide belly, that is, eating too much, does no good. It does not produce a fine intellect. It does not make a sharp mind. You cannot think well. Eat well, drink well, and then go and study, go and study, go and pray. You can't even pray. You can't even read. Once you've eaten too well, These young men, precisely because they ate foods that were not heavy and fatty and so on, were sharp as well. Their minds cut like a razor, and they rose to the highest offices. Both Daniel and the three youths, how were they able one day to say to that Nebuchadnezzar, "We will not bow down to the golden image of Marduk, the god, the patron of Babylon"? They had learned to say no to food, and so when they found themselves in the furnace, another miracle there, God protects them, and they are not burned. Children, I'd like to say a couple more words about your parents. You will ask, "Mother, father, mother, I don't know. Will you cook me something special?" It is no great thing to put a potato, a legume, on the side, to make me a vegetable dish, and to have it be a fasting meal. That is no hard thing. And then, the girls. Because I believe a girl raised this, perhaps you should learn to cook your own food as well. If your mother won't cook it. If your household insists. Well, we have dangerous reactions these days. Because supposedly, it would be a bad thing to say. If you put meat in front of me to eat, I won't eat it. I'll eat plain bread. I'll teach you, my dear mother, to cook me the fasting food. And do you know what the great thing is? Be sure of this. You will teach your very own parents to begin to fast. When you have steadfastness, don't bend. It is the steadfastness that fasting gives, when we love it and learn it, and it forms in us a character of steel, a beautiful character. And this character is built only through fasting in Christ. That is all for today, children.